Keep the conversation going after the 4 o'clock news. There've been so many calls tonight that we can't end it here, can we? So we've got, one or two more calls after the 4 o'clock news on the topics we've been discussing tonight. And then we'll get into, well, the podcast and all of that stuff. Still a while to go, an hour to go of the programme. Don't worry, we're here for you till five.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 4 o'clock. This is Justine Green. Sir Keir Starmer has warned Britain still in Lebanon to leave immediately as violence between Israel and Hezbollah escalates. Speaking on board a plane to New York, where he'll attend the annual UN General Assembly, the Prime Minister said the government was ramping up contingency plans. British troops are being sent to Cyprus to help possible evacuations. Here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
An additional 700 UK military personnel are being flown to Cyprus. Preparations for a potential evacuation of British nationals from Lebanon, if necessary. They'll join another 500 military personnel who are already in Cyprus, sent over the summer amid growing concerns of the deteriorating security situation in the Middle East. The fact that hundreds more are now being flown to Cyprus is a reflection of increasing concerns about the safety of at least 10,000 UK nationals still in Lebanon.
There's growing unease within the NHS in England about the government's message that the health service is broken. Senior sources have told the BBC they believe some of the comments and claims have gone too far and could result in lasting damage to patient and staff confidence in the NHS. The revelations come ahead of this morning's speech to the Labour Party conference by the Health Secretary Wes Streeting. Prosecutors in the US have charged a man with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Ryan Ruth, who's 58, was already facing two gun-related charges after he was accused of pointing a rifle through a fence at Mr. Trump's golf club in Florida earlier this month. Sean Combs, the US rapper also known as P. Diddy, is facing another lawsuit accusing him of rape. The latest allegation comes from a woman who says she was drugged and abused in his music studio. He denies all the charges. Our North America correspondent Emma Vardy reports from Los Angeles.
In a tearful press conference in LA, a woman called Talia Graves said she'd suffered years of emotional and psychological trauma from the alleged incident. She says Sean Combs and a colleague of his viciously raped her after allegedly giving her a spiked drink that caused her to briefly lose consciousness. At one point, she claims she was crying out for help. More than 20 years after the alleged attack, Talia Graves says she found out it had been videoed and shown to multiple men. Sean Combs has now been accused by more than 10 women of abuse and assaults.
A new global investment group says it aims to stop women's football becoming more financially reliant on the men's game. Mercury 13 have pledged to spend more than £80 million in building up a multi-club portfolio exclusively in women's football. Mario Malave, the co-founder of Mercury 13, says he's keen to invest in English football.
It's absolute priority and we want to be there hopefully very soon. So it's our job to make that happen and we're always looking at different opportunities and hopefully soon you'll see us make a move in the UK.
And that's the BBC News. It's 3 minutes past four.
This week on Five Live and Five Sports Extra.
Tomorrow there's ball by ball commentary from the county championship on Five Sports Extra.
He's in cold and that is that.
And tonight at 8, we'll have updates from the Europa League and live commentary as Liverpool face West Ham in the EFL Cup.
Five Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Dotun Adebayo.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
Can't you see I love you? Please don't break my heart in two. That's not hard to do, cause I don't have a wooden heart. And if you say goodbye, then I know that I would cry. Maybe I would die, cause I don't have a wooden heart. There's no strings upon this love of mine. It was always you from the start. Treat me nice, treat me good, treat me like you really should. Cause I'm not made of wood, and I don't have a wooden tongue.
All together now in the German. Well.
And
you know, when you're hearing Wooden Heart by Elvis, you know that when it goes into the German, there's only one of us who can sing it perfectly, and that is Linda in Hexham. This is your tune, Linda. Only for you, you know. Nobody else gets this tune. He's doing it in German again, isn't he? Mussi den, mussi den. Thank you, Elvis. Enough of you, Elvis. Let's talk to Linda in Hexham, if you don't mind, Elvis. Linda.
Beep, beep. My horse went, my horn went beep, beep, beep.
Oh, yes. What song was that again? Oh, my goodness. You mentioned that before.
Car.
What was it?
My little bubble car.
Okay, yeah, the bubble car.
I didn't have one, no.
No, good. I'm glad to hear that. But what first car did you have? What was your first car?
Well, I don't know what... I know that it was a Toyota, but I don't know what type of Toyota it
Japanese
was.
Japanese car. In those days, we never knew. We just knew it was Japanese, didn't we? We didn't know it was a Japanese XL5892. You know, who cared? Unless it was a Datsun Cherry. So it was a Japanese car, and this is in the days when Japanese cars were relatively new to us in this country.
This was in 1982.
Oh no, we'd had Japanese cars about a decade at this point, I'd have thought. So not entirely new. Was it any good? Was it the one that was in front of everybody else? You know, it being a Toyota. Apparently is a Toyota.
I was on my way to Germany with it.
Yeah.
And on the M4.
Yeah.
And there was this man with a big posh car sort of thing, and I was overtaking him, and he was overtaking me. We would have real fun on the M4.
Yeah, you're not supposed to have that much fun on the M4, but if that was the case, that was the case. I was wondering, though, is it a bit disrespectful? In those days, was it a bit disrespectful to take a Japanese car to Germany? Because, of course, Germany had the biggest car industry in Europe at the time. And, you know, they would look at Japanese cars and say,
My dad gave me the car.
Yeah.
And, I was only going over there to pick up my belongings because I'd left my husband.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you so you weren't going over there to spread, you know, peace and love amongst car owners, car manufacturers across the world. You weren't going over there for that reason. And I suppose it's a good way of sticking, you know, one or two or three fingers up at, you know, whatever you were not going to bring back home to the UK with you. I think I said that rather delicately myself.
You did, yeah.
What colour was it? Do you remember?
It was brown colour.
Brown, okay. So it wasn't the turquoise one, because Toyota did some car that was a turquoise one at some point. So what ugly, ugly colour at the time. So it wasn't that one.
It was a horrible colour.
And how long did you have the car? Yeah. How long did you have the car, do you remember?
Not long, because I couldn't afford to get it fixed.
Well,
I'm going through that
problem right now, you know. I've just convinced my missus to spend some money on fixing her car. And the guy told me, look, when I fix it, it's going to drive better than new. So I fell for the patter, of course, as you would. Mm. And, it's not quite driving as it was new. And I did this just yesterday evening. I said to my missus, do you want to go out for a spin on it? And she comes back and she goes, and I said, how was it? She looked at me with a very, very unhappy face and said, it's driving worse now than it was before.
Oh.
I don't know how I'm going to get out of this, Linda. I genuinely don't know how I'm going to get out of this because I can't afford to pay any more money for the car, for the fixing of the car. And my missus said, well, we should have just got rid of it beforehand. But I thought, let me give it one more, you know, chance in life. And I'm not sure if it's been successful. Anyway, that's my problem. Never mind that.
Yeah.
Go on.
I've got to get my car serviced on the 14th and MOT'd as well. And that's because it costs a chunk of money as well.
Well, Linda, good luck on that. And to make sure you do get it serviced. You know, make sure you do get it serviced properly because, you know, you need to drive a decent car after your Toyota experience, not to talk of your singing in German experience. I want to hear in German whether it's Vorsprung Technik and all of that. Great to speak to you. Yeah, whatever it is, whatever it is, I'm not going to remember that. It doesn't quite rhyme off the tongue or spin off the tongue like a wooden harp. Thank you, Linda in Hexham. Do remember, and you can still get in touch. We've still got time to talk some more. 08085909693 is the number. Look, these are the topics we'll be talking about tonight. If you missed the programme, you can listen again on BBC Sounds. But we've been talking about these subjects, which you can still join in with. And I've had a lot of calls, but happy to take your call as well. Should the government, or is it the government's job to legislate the country healthy, seems to want to do that and to impose some legislation to ensure that we're not such a burden on the NHS with our preventable diseases that the NHS is now obliged to try and wade into. 40% of the NHS's resources are spent on, preventable diseases. So the government's thinking, well, you know, maybe we should bring about some legislation that helps us become healthier and it will lighten the load on the NHS. Do you agree? Or is this, as some media commentators have called it, the nanny state? Yeah. Is anything wrong with the nanny state? Maybe there is. Yeah. Yeah. I think there might be for a lot of people who are calling it the nanny state. They're not doing it out of love, are they? It's not a term of endearment coming from certain quarters. Shabana Mahmood, who is the Justice Secretary, is saying that prisons aren't working for women. So fewer women should be serving time. We have to find an alternative way of punishing them or rehabilitating them, whatever it might be. Does Shabana Mahmood have a point? Your thoughts, please. And we've been asking you whether you've been scammed or there's been an attempt to scam you recently or perhaps not too recently. Share that attempt to scam or scam with us, with the nation, really. And you're doing us a service by trying to give us an insight into how they're operating, these scammers nowadays. And also, the final topic was about your first love, which, of course, is a car. You know, the first car, your first car was the first car or the first thing you fell in love with, wasn't it? Anyway, we've had a lot of stories about first cars tonight, and I'd love to hear yours. Every call tells a story on the nightclub. And the nightclub number is 08085909693. We'll take your call. We'll try and take your call before 5 o'clock at least. So let us remind you about the selection of the great podcasts that you can find on BBC Sounds. This morning, we're featuring Ukraine casts. And this week, President Zelensky is in the US for a diplomatic mission to try and sell President Biden his quote-unquote victory plan.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
It's 944 days since Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And this week, President Zelensky is in the United States for a marathon diplomatic mission.
Nice to meet you, Mr. President.
Hi, how are you?
See you soon.
Yes, again.
The timing is critical. President Biden only has months to go in the Oval Office. And President Zelensky, with his sense of timing, wants to ensure victory for Ukraine is on the top of his agenda when he comes to think of his legacy. So, in a very, perhaps we can say a very President Zelensky way, he started his time in the United States in President Biden's hometown, Scranton, Pennsylvania, where he visited a weapons factory.
Thank you very much to come here and to thank you
400 people saved millions of Ukrainians. Because
right now, the Ukrainian president is in New York for the United Nations General Assembly. The top table of world leaders, President Biden has delivered his farewell address.
We cannot grow weary. We cannot look away. And we will not let up on our support for Ukraine. Not until Ukraine wins a just and durable peace in the UN Charter.
So President Zelensky will rub shoulders with world leaders from the world over before he heads off to Washington, where he'll sit down with Joe Biden and with the two candidates vying to be his successor. And to all of them, he wants to pitch what he calls his victory plan.
It's a bridge to diplomatic way how to stop the war. The bridge is a plan of victory or victorious plan. It's a strengthening.
That was President Zelensky speaking in an interview with ABC News. So what is his victory plan? And can he persuade the Americans, and in particular American leaders, to support it? This is UkraineCast.
UkraineCast from BBC News.
Evil cannot be trusted. Ask Prigozhin.
You are not dealing with a politician, but with a bloody monster.
Is there a need for a serious opponent? Why?
Ukraine is unbroken, unbowed, and unconquered.
It's not just about Ukraine. It's about the whole future of Europe.
I don't understand what this war is for.
Hello, this is Lise Doucette, and I'm in our UkraineCast studio. Sadly, there's no Victoria or Vitaly today, but two friends of our podcast are here. Matthew Saville, who is the Director of Military Sciences at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, based in London. And Matthew, you also used to work for the Ministry of Defence.
Yes, 20 years, in fact.
We're very grateful you can bring in all your expertise and share it with us. And across the ocean, joining us early in the morning from Washington, is Angela Stent. She specialises in Russian foreign policy and US and European relations with Russia at Georgetown University. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning.
And I understand you've just come back from your first visit to the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, since the Russian invasion of February 2022. What was it like to be back?
I have. So, well, one major difference is the last time I went there, I flew into Borispol Airport in Kyiv. And of course, you can't do that anymore. So it's, I think, a more or less a 19-hour journey. I went to Warsaw. So we then took a bus to the border. We had a 10-hour train ride overnight, and then we got to Kyiv. Kyiv itself looks beautiful. People are going about their daily lives. I'm not going to say you wouldn't know that there was a war on. We all had to download the air siren alerts, and people are obviously very aware of it there, but the restaurants are open. People are living their lives with, you know, this terrible war there.
And you have come back to the United States, and you're there back home when President Zelensky is making a very crucial trip to the United States. How crucial is it for him?
I think it's very crucial. Ukraine's in a very difficult position. The Russians have recouped. Their military's recouped. I'm sure we'll hear more about that. They are really advancing slowly and with terrible casualties, but in the east, taking more territory. And even though the Ukrainians have had this incursion into the Kursk region in Russia and are staying there, the Russians are also pushing back there. Ukraine faces a mobilization crisis almost. It needs to mobilize and then train more young men and women. So for Zelensky, I think one of the major issues is he would like to be able to use the American long-range weapons to hit Russian targets further inside Russia. He needs more weapons. He needs them sooner. So it's really partly a plea for more help at this crucial time and at a time when public support, both in the U.S. and in most European countries, not all, is softening.
But to bring in Matthew here, you can say that every week is now crucial for Ukraine. But how would you see the significance of this one as he goes to the world's big gathering at the United Nations General Assembly as part of his American trip?
I'd say that to a certain degree, it's an opportunity to, as Angela said, if you like, make a series of points that are important for shoring up the current support. But a lot of this will also be about looking forward over the next 12 to 18 months. And you would expect address some of the challenges that sit behind the scenes. So the current debate that we're having around long-range weapons and certain other things, I would never call that a distraction, but it isn't the kind of the core fundamental issues about the military balance and the strategy for the war that will set up the Ukrainians for success or otherwise. And that remains in large part around mobilisation, training, equipping those forces, and then looking at the balance on the field and what the situation looks like. And of course, what Zelensky will have in mind is the forthcoming US election, the political landscape in the wake of that, and indeed the knock-on effect to international, but particularly European support.
But doesn't this trip remind us of how, you remember early on in the war, President Zelensky was hailed as the master communicator, knowing when to say what word at what time in which capital. And the timing of this seems significant. He knows President Biden is in his last months in office. He knows President Biden is thinking of his legacy. He's appealing to him to say, make victory in Ukraine, independent Ukraine, part of your legacy. And in his masterful style, he starts his visit by going to President Biden's hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania, to see a weapons factory.
Yes, I think the challenge there will be, and people who are, you know, real avid US politics watchers will know better than I, is that it's actually quite difficult to, if you like, bind in one administration to another. So even if Zelensky has in mind a potential future Trump administration, and a lot of this, and maybe even Kursk, looks like an attempt to hedge against that possibility, there is still the matter of congressional politics, the involvement of, if you like, other figures beyond the president. So in that respect, it is aimed at multiple audiences. But of course, there's a high degree of variability in what US support will look like, regardless of the election result. And I would add the big strategic picture, any future US president is going to have half an eye at least, if not more, on the Indo-Pacific and China. And I think that's something that's probably a cause for concern in the background of Ukrainian minds.
But Zelensky being Zelensky is, we understand, going to see President Biden, Kamala Harris, and former President Trump. Let's just remind ourselves about what President Trump has been saying about Ukraine.
I see Zelensky is here. I think Zelensky is the greatest salesman in history. Every time he comes into the country, he walks away with $60 billion. Billion! Walks in with $60 billion. He wants them to win this election so badly. But I would do differently. I will work out peace before I'm even before. As president-elect, if I win this election, the first thing I'm going to do is call up Zelensky and call up President Putin. And I'm going to say, you got to make a deal. This is crazy.
Angela, we're hearing that President Zelensky is thinking that he has to get through to the advisors around President Trump to convince them that victory in Ukraine will be, in effect, victory for President Trump if indeed he returns to the White House. How hard is that going to be?
I think that's going to be very difficult. The vice presidential candidate, J.D. Vance, has come out with a peace plan that is exactly the same as Vladimir Putin's peace plan, which is that, you know, Ukraine should accept the loss of all the territories. It should say it's never going to join NATO. It should demilitarize part of its territories. So Trump's advisors are more or less all on the same page. Not all Republicans are. I mean, you have many Republicans in the Senate and in the House of Representatives who are very supportive of Ukraine. But I think this is going to be a very hard sell. Trump's base doesn't think the U.S. should be spending money on Ukraine. So we don't know who all the people advising former President Trump on Ukraine are, but the ones that we do know certainly would agree with President Trump that this has to end. Trump's other line, He was beamed into the conference I was at, is had he been president, this war would never have started, and that he has excellent relations with both President Putin and President Zelensky. So, but they're definitely determined they say, to stop this war. How they'll stop it in 24 hours is very interesting, but there really isn't much support amongst his base for continued aid to Ukraine.
That kind of scepticism that appears to be prevalent amongst a reasonable chunk, not the totality, of the Republican base is particular cause for concern, because even if you think you can persuade Trump, he is still kind of quite mercurial.
Transactional. Exactly.
And so the danger is that he has already, if you like, sold the pass in terms of his kind of willingness to make major commitments to this cause. And therefore, if you're the Russians, you might expect, well, maybe we can offer something that he can put his name on as a deal. The terms don't actually matter. The end, in inverted commas, of the conflict, which would really just freeze it, would be to their advantage. And I think that's the problem is that Zelensky needs to come with something that is convincing enough that Trump takes the alternative view and sticks to it in the face of what might be pressure from his supporters. So the supplemental at the start of this year, Trump actually ended up, if you like, kind of giving the green light.
After a long, long delay,
exactly.
Which cost Ukraine on the battlefield.
Yeah, and I can come back to how that happened. But so he is persuadable, but the problem is the effort that is required to do so is pretty significant. And the idea that, I mean, he's obviously flipped on that already because he's seeking to extract more. I mean, there's a high degree of variability in how he approaches this problem.
But it's a tall hill to climb for President Zelensky, who, as we heard in that clip from President Trump, just calls him a salesman. Let's see if the going will be tough with Vice President Kamala Harris.
If Donald Trump were president, Putin would be sitting in Kyiv right now. And understand what that would mean, because Putin's agenda is not just about Ukraine. Understand why the European allies and our NATO allies are so thankful that you are no longer president, and that we understand the importance of the greatest military alliance the world has ever known, which is NATO, and what we have done to preserve the ability of Zelensky and the Ukrainians to fight for their independence. Otherwise, Putin would be sitting in Kyiv with his eyes on the rest of Europe.
Angela, when you hear that, we're reminded that there's very little light between how President Biden approaches the war in Ukraine, the threat posed by Russia to all of Europe, and how Kamala Harris views it now and is likely to view it if she reaches the White House as the president.
I mean, at the moment, yes, continuity, they're on the same page. And she's met many times with Zelensky, and she's supportive of this policy. And her advisors, current advisors in the vice president's office, share this view. We don't know, were she to be elected, how the policy would develop next year. There will still be, you know, the kind of financial constraints that the U.S. has already seen, and the constraints in terms of our own military production, weapons production, for supporting Ukraine. But there's no reason to think that the policy would change greatly under Harris, because she is committed to this policy.
But it is a huge amount of money at a time when Americans are suffering and worrying about the cost of living.
It is. And I think that the money that was the supplemental we've already talked about was passed this year. I think that this is kind of the peak of the amount of financial support that Ukraine's going to get from the United States. It's going to be much more difficult to do it next year. I think one thing behind Zelensky's agenda now in the U.S. is to try and persuade President Biden to use the last few months of his presidency to get some more assistance through, to lift the ban on Ukraine using these weapons further into Russian territory, and during the lame duck session of Congress in December, maybe to get Congress also to pass some more assistance for Ukraine. Because I think the Ukrainians realize that next year, it's whoever is president, even if it's Kamala Harris, that it'll be much more difficult to continue these flows of money.
Well, that's why perhaps he has packaged it all up in what he is describing as a victory plan. And I'm assuming he's going to sell it as, our victory will be your victory too. Angela, I know you need to go. Even at this early hour, you have things to do. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, of course, not all of the details have come out, but enough have in what he is describing as a victory plan. And from what we understand is that there's three, possibly 4 points. Security guarantees, the incursion into Kursk across the border into Russia. Point three, as we've already been discussing, specific advanced weapons. And there seemed to be a fourth point as well, the economy. Let's go through those four. The security guarantees. It's also being said that President Zelensky wants to Trump-proof to ensure there's no rolling back. What kind of guarantees could he get in a plan like this?
The one that they have, of course, been focused on, the Ukrainians, that is, up until now, has been NATO membership.
Mm.
I think they were disappointed that there wasn't something more concrete on the table at the NATO summit, although, to be fair, I think the writing was on the wall for that. So what you have instead got is a number of countries, and the UK is one of them, have signed, if you like, bilateral agreements that include versions of a security guarantee. Some ideas have come out recently about, well, could we extend things like no-fly zones? Could you put a partial no-fly zone over eastern Ukraine?
Which Zelensky has been calling for. Indeed. Close the skies from the beginning.
So it's not impossible that there'll be a discussion around something like that. The difficulty is they all involve at some point members of NATO deploying forces to shoot at either Russian weapons or Russian personnel.
Mm.
So there's a real devil in the detail question there. And I think you would have to sell to various countries the mechanics. So the security guarantees discussion, I think, really should be a backdoor to the other points around concrete international support, which means material, weapons, training. There are, if you like, lesser security arrangements that could take place that both fulfill a practical purpose, but that also show a degree of political commitment, but they all carry risk. For example, some of the international training that's being conducted outside Ukraine could be conducted inside Ukraine. And international personnel from a number of countries could start doing that on the ground, say, in Western Ukraine. There could be much more industrial capacity that is moved forward into Ukraine, you know, international backers, companies working there, some, you know, number are already doing so.
But that could increase the risks, right?
Absolutely.
You know, they could be targeted as Western training courses have been targeted before.
Indeed. So if you were putting a training presence in country and the Russians bombed the training site, let's say, and killed international personnel, well, that wouldn't necessarily be a NATO Article 5 incident because it's not geographically covered by the provisions. But would countries effectively bear that cost? Would they regard that as an escalation? What's the messaging that goes around it? So there are things that international partners can do on the commitment front that, if you like, show that they are prepared to take more risk on behalf of Ukraine, but they do need to understand what that risk is.
So that's what we think is the first point, security guarantees. The second one just says that word, Kursk, which is a very shorthand way of saying Ukrainian forces made this very daring raid right across the border without, we understand, informing their allies, seeing it, as far as we understand, as a way to put pressure on Russia. There's some dispute about whether that actually has achieved. But if it is part of this so-called victory plan, the idea would be that the more we kind of get Russia inside Russia, this strengthens our position?
Yeah, so a lot of that sounds like it's a kind of a shorthand for changing the balance of Putin's calculations, changing his interests. So exactly, I mean, there's a lot of tactical benefits to, or theoretical benefits to, the Kursk operation. But the big one is you have territory to trade if it comes to negotiations. Now, I'd suggest that feels a bit like a fallback position. The Ukrainians wouldn't want to be negotiating where they currently are, even if they're holding territory on Russia, given what's happening in the east of the country, the fact that they don't control Crimea. So that's, if you like, a bit of an insurance policy that if, for example, you had a Trump presidency and he enforced talks early on, that they would have something to physically trade back. I think the challenge with that is, I think you can sort of take with a pinch of salt Trump's "I would negotiate as president-elect," because, of course, in the US system, there's only one president at one time. He can't really negotiate as president-elect. So that means in material terms, even if you had back-channel discussions, you would have to be holding that territory through into 2025. Whilst that is happening, those forces in Kursk will be taking casualties. They will be being chipped away. It's probably not a very pleasant place to be at the moment, given what's coming in. There is a danger that what that is doing is actually eroding forces that they would much prefer to have in reserve for a potential counteroffensive next year.
Or the opportunity costs in the east, where they are losing territory, and that is vital, vital territory.
And that has absolutely been the case. And so the problem is, even if you assume that is being held back for negotiations, they would have to spend even more resources. It becomes a sunk cost, so that it is worth something to hand it back. Because the alternative is that they go into negotiations. Their position is roughly how it looks at the moment, but shaky. The Russians might say, well, you can withdraw, or we will just now roll in with more human wave type attacks, because they can bear the cost of those immense casualties for a little bit longer.
Mm. Point three, if it is indeed point three, about specific advanced weapons, let's hear from one of our listeners. Brendan in Rugby had a question on this.
Hello to the Ukraine cast. My mum lived through World War II and was taught that careless talk costs lives. Why then are we openly discussing Western long-range weapons being used in Ukraine? Surely talking about it gives Putin time to set up his counter-responses and his lies about the NATO aggression.
Talking about it has already given some advance warning to the Russians. So there is reporting that the US has briefed out that appears to have been backed up by some open source analysis that, for example, most of the aircraft that are operating from just over the border in Russia that are responsible for launching glide bomb attacks on both Ukrainian forces and Ukrainian cities have now been pulled back out of the range of some of these Western supplied systems. Now, there are some advantages to that. Those aircraft now have to come from further away. That means they can fly fewer sorties per day. So it maybe reduces the rate at which they can operate individually. But the reporting suggests there are still a lot of these attacks going in. I am slightly speculating, but I think the extent to which it has been talked about this time round is reflective of a degree of urgency and desperation that the Ukrainians feel, because it was President Zelensky soon after Keir Starmer came in who really talked about it as if essentially agreement had already been made. And it feels like that was partly because he was trying to force the pace of the discussion and particularly force the American hand on their weapons.
So to be clear, is this, from what we can see, more likely to involve permission to use the advanced weapons which have already been agreed and are on the ground? Or are there other weapons that President Zelensky is asking for and still hasn't got?
So, there might be. There's occasionally a little bit of chatter about a US air-launched cruise missile, which has a longer range and could be provided in more quantities. Zelensky might be looking for more of the weapons that he's currently been provided, because the stocks are probably quite low. They've been using some of these for 16 months now. I think there's a twofold reason for talking about this subject. One is the political benefit he's made it almost like a political test of will by going so public. The political benefit from international backers being seen to face down Russian rhetoric. And the Ukrainians would argue that the escalation rhetoric is hollow and the Russians are basically trying to dissuade international support. It might be that they're also trying to unlock broader support for Ukraine's own deep strike capabilities, their drone program, which has much longer ranges than some of these weapons, but often with smaller warheads, and they have to use a lot of them to break through. And actually, more industrial support for Ukraine's own production would really ramp up the deep strike program and actually could be complemented by some of these weapons. So the US ballistic missile ATACMS, if that could be used against Russian radar and air defence sites, you could then actually get more drones through to hit deeper targets.
This is one of the new mantras now, deep strike. The deeper we strike, the greater our strike will be. Just one last point. The media reporting on this so-called victory plan, some say three, some say four. But if there is a fourth point, which is the economy, financial support, that just seems an obvious thing to ask. They can't really keep going without significant financial support.
Yeah.
And the European Union has also, we should say, we've been focusing mainly on the Americans. The European Union has really been trying to top that up too.
Yes, and I think, the way that the Ukrainians managed to, if you like, reopen exports via the Black Sea. It was an example of a sort of a military line of activity that supported, you know, the economic viability of the Ukrainian state. But, you know, things are really thin. There's a massive amount of infrastructure reinvestment that's required, given how much of the energy grid has been hit and other critical infrastructure, the kind of long-term commitment to help rebuild that. What will hopefully be being discussed in the background in terms of the victory plan and the future is what is the future requirement for training and equipment, and how is that married at all together so that that can be set out for international partners so they can actually plan to try and meet as much of that demand as possible.
Yes, the EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, once said to me in his blunt way, the cupboards are bare, we don't have enough. Well, we'll soon see what is in the cupboard for President Zelensky. Matthew Saville from Brusy, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your expertise with us.
My pleasure to come in and chat about this.
And to you, all of our loyal Ukrainecast listeners, wherever you're listening in the world, do keep listening and take care. Goodbye.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.
Yeah, there'll be another BBC Sounds podcast about the same time tomorrow morning. The time now is 5:20.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News on 5 Live. Sir Keir Starmer has warned Britons still in Lebanon to leave immediately as violence between Israel and Hezbollah escalates. Speaking ahead of a meeting at the US General Assembly later, the Prime Minister said the government was ramping up contingency plans. British troops are being sent to Cyprus to help possible evacuations. Senior sources in the NHS in England have told the BBC that they're concerned about the government's message that the health service is broken and that it could result in lasting damage to patient and staff confidence in the NHS. The revelations come ahead of this morning's speech to the Labour Party conference by the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting. Sean Combs, the US rapper also known as P. Diddy, is facing another lawsuit accusing him of rape. The latest allegation comes from a woman who says she was drugged and abused in his music studio. He denies all the charges. And prosecutors in the US have charged a man with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Ryan Ruth, who's 58, was already facing two gun-related charges after the incident at Mr. Trump's golf club in Florida earlier this month. Five Live Sport now has Shabnam Yunus-Jewell.
All four Premier League teams made it through to the fourth round of the EFL Cup, but Leicester had to squeeze past League Two Walsall on penalties. They won the shootout 3-0. Chelsea comfortably beat Barrow 5-0 at Stamford Bridge with a hat-trick for Christopher Nkunku. Aston Villa won 2-1 at Wycombe Wanderers, and Manchester City beat Watford 2-1. When asked about Rodri, City manager Pep Guardiola said he will be out for a long time, but they're still waiting for doctors to confirm the severity of the injury. The midfielder was taken off during City's draw with Arsenal on Sunday.
Still, I don't know the final decision was going to happen, because some doctors said it's a big injury. The other one said not as much. So, yeah, we'll see. Rodri, his position, maybe is arguably the best midfield player in the world. So, as a replacer. So, it's a big loss. Absolutely.
Meanwhile, Wimbledon are still dealing with the flooding of their stadium that postponed their home match against Newcastle to next week at St James's Park. More than 100,000 litres of water has been pumped out of their Plough Lane home, and the League Two club are unsure when they'll be able to stage home games again. And England cricket captain Harry Brook hit a first one-day international century to help them win a rain-affected third match against Australia by 46 runs on the Duckworth-Lewis-Sterr method. The match was abandoned, giving England the much-needed victory to stay in this series. They're now 2-1 down with two matches left to play.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK. On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Hello there, good morning. Well, following the recent rain, there's still a number of flood warnings and plenty of flood alerts in place, particularly across the South Midlands. And there is more rain to come here too later on today, and more rain across the whole of the UK today and tomorrow. And then into Friday and the weekend, it's set to turn a lot colder, but it should at least be drier by then. So it's a cooler start to this morning than we saw this time yesterday, generally 5 to 8 degrees Celsius in the north, although some of the sheltered glens of Scotland could be even chillier than that, and 8 to 12 degrees Celsius further south 13s and 14s along the south coast. There is a low pressure system rolling in from the southwest as we head through this morning, bringing cloud and outbreaks of heavy, quite persistent rain. Some more showers affecting parts of southern England too. But most of the rain out towards southwest England, eventually pushing northwards and eastwards across Wales and central southern England as we head through the afternoon, approaching the south Midlands, across the flooded fields, of course, too. But for Northern Ireland, it should stay largely dry. It'll stay dry too for much of Scotland away from the far north, where there will be some showers. Northern England, cloud increasing through the day, but again, it's largely dry. That's also true across eastern areas of England too. The cloud will thicken through the afternoon as that rain approaches. Top temperatures later today, 14 to 17 degrees Celsius in the south, but 11 to 14 Celsius further north. Now, as we head through tonight, that rain system continues to push further northwards and eastwards. As we head through the day tomorrow, it's going to be heavy and very persistent with brisk easterly winds out towards northeast England, particularly in the North York Moors. And that rain stretches further west into Northern Ireland too. To the north of the front and to the south, there will be a lot of dry weather. And then that front sinks southwards on Friday, introducing that cold northerly wind. Elizabeth Rizzini, 5 Live Weather.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
Dotun Adebayo. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Pete in Salford tells us that his first car was a 1959 Ford 10FE. He paid £1.50 for it. That was in 1974. I think it's fair to say he paid £1.10 for it, because even though £1.50 was the actual currency at that time, we'd had the 50 pence piece by 1974, we still called it £1.10. And that's what he paid for his first car in 1959. I thought mine was going to be hard to beat, because mine was a old-style Morris 1100, racing green, of course, and that was £70. And I thought, well, and that was in 1977. I thought that would be hard to beat, but just goes to show. If I'd been born 3 years earlier, I could have got change from a couple of quid for my car. Thank you. Thank you for that information, Pete and Suffolk. We're all jealous of you. Oh, and Maureen says, Dotun, could you cheer us up by telling us about the day you received your MBE? Well, I could do, but it's not that kind of program, Maureen. So if you don't mind, and thank you, by the way, if you don't mind, I'll put everything in the safe hands of young journalist Beth Robinson, who's been looking at the headlines that you'll be waking up to this morning. She's been going through the front pages with me.
So my top story today is from the Metro, and it's 10 years to end zombie apocalypse. It's basically just covering the knife crime. So the most recent one that happened, and the young 15-year-old boy who was killed. And I saw a really, really awful video where a witness said the boy, as he'd just been stabbed, he basically said, "I'm 15, don't let me die," something along them lines. And I think knife crime is such a horrible thing to happen to anyone, but a young 15-year-old boy, and hearing them words as a witness, is something that no one should have to experience that. And the fact that they're saying it's going to be 10 years to end it all, I think there are so many things that they could do to end it so much quicker, and it's been going on for so long now that you would have hoped they'd just be putting more and more into place. I know there's three mums up in Middlesbrough who've lost their children to knife crime. And they've been putting a lot of things into place and really fighting for this to happen. So it doesn't look like there is going to be quite a bit of a change. But I feel like 10 years is still just a bit too long.
Well, it's 10 years to halve knife crime, not to end it.
Yeah, so sorry,
even 10
to
years.
Harvey,
no,
yeah.
That's all right. The headline makes it look as if, you know, it's 10 years to bring it to an end. 10 years to end zombie apocalypse. But it's not 10 years. They got it wrong. It's the Metro that have got it wrong, surprisingly. But that was a stronger headline, wasn't it? But it's 10 years, according to the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper. She's promised to halve knife crime in a decade. What you said, I mean, there's a couple of things I want to talk to you about. It's a really interesting, it's interesting conversation between you and I, because I did read those words from the dying boy, I'm only 15, and that struck me, but I think I read it a day ago, and today the newspapers are dominated by headlines from the Labour Party conference, and that was what I would have thought was a lead story for everybody, but we sometimes live in a media bubble, those of us of a certain age anyway, that we think the politics is the top story and always will be. If the Prime Minister says something, he is the person that has most power in the country, so therefore as journalists we immediately go for that. But you, coming from a younger perspective, dare I say, without being patronising, you see the 10 years to end zombie apocalypse as the top story. That's really intriguing to me. I'm concerned that I might be missing out myself as a journalist on the stories that really matter. Why does this story really matter to you?
I think, well, like I said, I think knife crime is something that it does need to be focused on a lot more. There needs to be so much more. Well, there needs to be so much more awareness around it. I don't think people realise how common it is and actually how awful the situation is. Like you said, I think one of the most important things in journalism is sharing stories that actually have emotion behind them and that are getting out to people and making people connect to them in some sort of way. And maybe sometimes it's not always in a positive way, but like you said, I think some of the top stories should have been from what the young boy had said and not really what the conference was saying, because at the end of the day it's another thing that the government are saying, and I think a lot of the time it will just go over people's heads and it's not going to be something that's too important, but people want to connect to other people, and hearing some, well, being able to read what that last boy's words were be so much more impactful to readers.
But do we connect, though? I wonder if that isn't the problem. Is the issue, because you're right, the power of journalism is to be able to connect us in that way, to make us feel something for our fellow human beings. But if you don't connect, if you go about thinking, all right, another death from knife crime, it will never happen to me or any of my loved ones. I don't live in that landscape. Do you know what I mean? You suddenly start thinking, well, this is a story that doesn't affect me and I'm not connecting with the story and it doesn't mean as much to me. I'm not saying that from my perspective, but I can see why people think, well, oh my goodness. You know, and dare I say, another black boy being the victim of knife crime.
Yeah, I think maybe because while I was at uni, there was a boy who quite a few of my friends knew down in Fallowfield. He was a victim of knife crime, and it was really big. And he went to school with a girl that I knew. And I think since then, it made me realise that, yeah, things like these are actually way more common than it really is. And I do think people would be able to connect to that kind of story. And I think because and I think the words that the boy said and how the witnesses come forward and said that, I think that is something where you'd be completely heartless to not be able to connect to that kind of story. And I think a lot of people know people that kind of age. I think it's just something that a lot of people would be able to connect with. And like I said, I think if people weren't, then they would be heartless. But I do think it would have been a much stronger story and something where there would have been more of a point behind it, maybe, than just, like I said, it's another thing that the government is saying, another thing that the government is saying they're going to do. And I think because it's such a long plan for something that isn't necessarily guaranteed, and it's only half the knife crime that they're saying they're going to, they said they're only going to half the knife crime. It's just really sad, to be honest.
We have got really important jobs as journalists. I don't need to tell you that, Beth. You have got a really important job as a young journalist coming up. And we know that they're important jobs because, you know, the Prime Minister insisted that we work throughout the pandemic, previous Prime Minister Boris Johnson, because journalism matters. It's a really important, it's not a traditional profession. Anybody can be a journalist. You don't need the qualifications, do you? So traditional professions, you needed certain qualifications to be able to call yourself a doctor or a lawyer or whatever it might be. It's not a profession in that sense, but nevertheless, for what it's worth, it is a profession. And we can make these stories matter. It matters to you. And as a journalist, your job is to make it matter to all of us, you know. And I'm reeling back. I'm actually reeling back because I didn't think that was the top story this morning, but now I do. So thank you for that. However, needs must get back on to the other story that dominates the papers, rightly or wrongly. Keir Starmer kissing his wife, essentially.
Yeah, I'm really confused as to why quite a few of the papers have chosen that. I was actually going to ask you more on your opinions on that because I'm baffled by it. I don't really understand why that's become the main picture.
Well, I'll tell you exactly what you said. I said to our editor tonight exactly those words. You can go and ask him. I said exactly those words. I was particularly baffled by the... So, for those who don't know, pictures of Keir Starmer and his wife, the Prime Minister and his wife, having a little snog on stage at the Labour Party conference in Liverpool. You know, legitimate, good old, no sex please, we're British snog, it has to be said. nevertheless, and with the backdrop of the, you know... union flag. It's a striking picture. But when you look at the headlines, particularly on one or two of the papers, it does seem a little bit incongruous because the Daily Telegraph's headline is "The State Will Take Back Control." And I kid you not, underneath that headline is a photograph of Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, and his wife in an embrace. And it's a lips-to-lips embrace. And I'm like, how does that go with the headline, "The State Will Take Back Control"? Do you know what I mean? I'm a little bit confused, but tell me why you were confused, though.
Well, I just thought it was weird. I just thought it was really strange to pick that as the picture. And especially, well, for example, the Metro. Obviously, I know that's a completely different section to it, but... to have that next to a story that sensitive, I don't know. I think there was a couple of other pages where there was a really sensitive story and that was next to it. I don't know. I just thought it was really just bizarre.
Yeah, I can understand that. Beth Robinson there with the headlines that you'll be waking up to this morning. That's about it from us. Thank you to the team tonight. Thank you for listening, by the way. But cheers also to Ollie and Aaron taking your calls, to Jason producing, and to Sol Maz and Alex in the studio, and to Paul who edited the programme. I'm back tomorrow from 1 o'clock with the jukebox. Do remember, bring your dancing shoes. And don't forget, you can listen again to every nightclub on BBC Sounds. So let's play you out with the track to inspire you for the day ahead. This one is for D in Fame. Tame, rather than Fame. Too much monkey business for me to be involved in. I've been to Yokohama.
the hammer, been fighting in the war. Army bunk, army child, army crew, army car. Ha. Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business for me to be involved. Working in the filling station, too many tasks. Wipe the windows, check the tires, check the oil, a dollar gas. Ha. Too much monkey business. Too much monkey business. I don't want your botheration. Get away, leave me be. Too much monkey business for me.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 5 o'clock. This is Justine Green. The government has told British nationals to leave Lebanon immediately as fighting between Israel and Hezbollah escalates. Additional troops are being sent to Cyprus as part of contingency plans to evacuate British people. Health officials in Lebanon say more than 560 people have been killed within 48 hours. Israel has accused Hezbollah of hiding weapons in residential areas. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams is in Jerusalem.
Despite the fact that Hezbollah is firing rockets and some of those rockets further into Israel than before, what we haven't seen Hezbollah doing is using its much vaunted supply of longer range, sometimes precision guided weapons. Now, is that because they can't? Because of the damage inflicted on the group by Israel over the last week, or because they're holding back?
Senior sources have told the BBC there's growing unease within the NHS in England about the government's message that the health service is broken. There are concerns the comments could stop patients seeking help. The Department of Health said it was important to be honest about the scale of the challenge facing the health service. The US rapper and producer Sean Combs, also known as P. Diddy, is facing another accusation of rape. In a lawsuit filed in New York, a woman has alleged she was drugged and raped by Combs and one of his colleagues in the star's music studio more than 20 years ago. Talia Graves told journalists how her life had been affected.
Some of the hardest parts of this pain are the shame and the guilt I have experienced that plays a negative part in my day-to-day ability to function properly, being blamed, questioned, and threatened has often made me feel worthless.
More than 10 women have now accused the star of abuse and assault, which he denies. Prosecutors in the US have charged a man with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Ryan Roth, who's 58, was already facing two gun-related charges after he was accused of pointing a rifle through a fence at Mr. Trump's golf club in Florida earlier this month. Our North America correspondent David Willis is following developments.
Ryan.